ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Arts in 30, your weekly wrap of global news in arts and culture. I'm Daniel Browning. The gallerist representing sacked Venice Biennale artist Khaled Sabsabi breaks his silence exclusively here on Arts in 30. Josh Malani says while Creative Australia's leadership must go, the arts funding body is vital to the health of the arts ecosystem. Green Senator Sarah Hanson-Young seconds the move for regime change at Creative Australia in announcing her party's arts policy in the lead-up to the federal election. But first, to the headlines with Sky Kirkham.
Hi, Daniel.
Now, a very successful Oscars for independent films.
Hugely successful. And Anora was the big winner, which I was personally thrilled about. It's a wonderful film. Sean Baker became the first person to win four different Oscars for a single movie after the film took out Best Picture, Director, Editing, and Original Screenplay. Anora's star, Mikey Madison, also took out Best Actress. In the other categories, Adrien Brody won Best Actor, and I'm Still Here won Best International Feature. No Other Land won Best Documentary, despite not having distribution in America, and that win led to the most political moment of the night.
When I look at Basel, I see my brother, but we are unequal. We live in a regime where I am free, under civilian law, and Basel is under military laws that destroy his life and he cannot control. There is a different path, a political solution, without ethnic supremacy, with national rights for both of our people.
And Flow, which won Best Animated Film, became the first Latvian movie to win an Oscar.
Now, WA's Premier Roger Cook isn't happy with Peter Garrett.
No, it's been reported that during a performance with his group The Alter Egos at the Perth Festival over the weekend, Garrett urged his audience to, quote, pretend they're dancing on Gina Rinehart's grave. The West Australian paper has jumped on the remarks, and the Premier, who is about to head to polls for the state election, has condemned the comments, saying that the arts are also there to challenge us, and perhaps Peter Garrett thought that he was challenging the people of WA when he made his inappropriate comments. He wasn't, quite frankly. He was being disrespectful and sowing the sort of seeds of hatred that we do see around the place. So he's got to stop.
Now, what are the quick hits?
Matthew Lutton has been announced as the new head of the Adelaide Festival for 2026 to 2028. It follows the sudden departure of Ruth McKenzie late last year, who left to take on a role within the South Australian Government's Department of Premier and Cabinet. For the last 9 years, Lutton has been the artistic director and co-CEO of Malthouse Theatre in Melbourne, and he becomes the fourth head of the Adelaide Festival in the last 4 years. Hopefully a bit of stability this time for the festival. Charlie XCX was the big winner at the Brit Awards, taking out Album, Song and Artist of the Year. In sad news, police are waiting on a toxicology report after Gene Hackman, his wife and his dog were found dead in their home in Santa Fe. Hackman, of course, was a screen legend, winning an Oscar for Best Actor for The French Connection and Best Supporting Actor for Unforgiven. Now, recent reports indicate that the actor, who was 95, died 9 days before the bodies were discovered, and local authorities have ruled out foul play, but other details remain unavailable at this point. Over in the UK, a new album, Is This What We Want?, has been released. It features 1,000 musical artists, including stars like Kate Bush, Tori Amos, Cat Stevens, The Pet Shop Boys. Amazing lineup. But it might not sound quite like what you're expecting. It is 12 tracks of various lengths of silence, recorded in different recording studios, and it's intended as a protest against AI being trained on unlicensed work. The titles of the track spell out, the British government must not legalise music theft to benefit AI companies.
So we're in the business called Atmos, Atmosphere.
It is very useful if you ever need to fill in some gaps on a song.
Indeed. Sky, thank you.
Thanks.
You're listening to Arts in 30 on ABC Radio National. I'm Daniel Browning. Josh Malani represents some of Australia's leading artists. Richard Bell, Hodder Afshar, Vernon Arkey, Megan Cope, Dee Harding and Khaled Sabsabi, who was dumped as Australia's rep at the 2026 Venice Biennale after some political heat over two early works. Sabsabi and curator Michael D'Agostino had won an exhaustive tender process fair and square to represent Australia at the world's oldest and foremost biennial. the biggest outing there is for an Australian artist on the international stage. But after a gossip column in The Australian raised concerns about two of Susabi's early works, it prompted a question from the opposition's newly minted arts spokeswoman, blindsiding Government Senate Leader Penny Wong and Arts Minister Tony Burke. Just hours later, after a phone call to CEO Adrian Collette and a hastily convened board meeting, a panicked Creative Australia rescinded the commission, an unprecedented move that led to claims of rank political interference and censorship. It's also stoked fears of Brandis-style cuts to the sector and reputational damage for Australia after winning the prestigious Golden Lion for Best National Pavilion in 2024. Josh Malani, welcome to Arts in 30. We know there's a crisis of confidence in the arts community following the board's decision to sack Khaled Subsabi. You're speaking out because this crisis, you say, can be mitigated. What do you think needs to happen?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that the leadership of Creative Australia has had a collapse of confidence and has abandoned its central purpose, which really is to support artists and to defend them. It would seem to me that the court of public opinion and the majority of people within the sector believe that the only way that this can be resolved is by the chairman of the board and the current CEO to stand down and allow new leadership to take charge of Creative Australia, and also for Khaled Subsabi to be reinstated. That would really be, in my view, the only way that this mess can be fixed and for the sector to heal and move on with confidence in Creative Australia, because it is so important that Creative Australia, which generally does very, very good work, is able to continue that good work.
Now, you represent Khaled. You're personally impacted in some ways by the decision that Creative Australia has made. How much of your response is personal rather than a matter of broad principles about the health of the sector?
It's personal insofar as I care deeply for Khaled's well-being. And, you know, I know him well, and I've known him for over 12 years. And he's a very sensitive and intelligent person, and this has obviously affected him. But both Khaled and I have discussed this, and really it's about the sector. Australian art, you know, for a long time has really been seen as peripheral to the mainstream narrative of art internationally. And in recent years, the sector's made some incredible advances. And really, that's been a collective effort. You know, it's been the work of great artists. It's been the work of gallerists. But it's also been the work of Creative Australia, who've helped support projects and give the cultural framework for many of these artists to flourish. And the most recent example of that one can point to is the great success of Archie Moore at the last Venice Biennale. You know, that's really unprecedented and is one of the most incredible achievements in the history of Australian art. So we're on a winning streak, you know, and to trip over this hurdle just seems like a kind of self-masochism, if I can put it that way, that is totally unnecessary and was avoidable, I believe.
Yeah, the decision-making at Creative Australia, there are some questions to be asked about that, and there is a review underway which the taxpayer is paying for. Mm. You know, Creative Australia is absolutely vital. The arts ecology will, I mean, it's fair to say it could collapse if there's no viable way for government funding to be received for art making. There will be no ecology, as far as I'm concerned. It would collapse. What's your view about that?
Well, I think that's a fair assessment, because Creative Australia does so much of the work to support artists in the experimental phase, in the research and development phase. And it also helps artists to present their work, you know, in platforms that might be local or national, but also internationally. And the reality is, for artists to flourish, they need support, but the support can come from various sectors. You know, I'm a commercial gallerist, so I produce income for artists through sales of their work or through opportunities in the commercial sector. But really, that's not possible without the cultural context. And for so many years, Australia has suffered from the tyranny of distance, which is a very well-known idea. And we're not on a level playing field, as it were, with artists in Europe who are closer to the core markets. And so for our artists to be able to exhibit in those forums, such as the Venice Biennale, and to show really what an enormously rich talent pool we have here, leads inevitably to economic outcomes. So, for example, now I'm currently selling 50% of my income is coming from international markets, whereas 5 years ago, I would have said it was 10%. So there's been a shift in the last few years.
And that's without like a lot of self-promotion, right?
Almost none. I mean, if you looked at my, I don't advertise. I have an Instagram feed that one could fairly describe as meager.
Inconsistent is what I'd call it.
Yeah. Well, thank you. That's very flattering. I would say it's through supporting artists to exhibit widely and in culturally significant forums, such as, you know, the Sha Sha Biennial or Documenta. I've supported artists to do projects in the Hawaii Biennale, in the Venice Biennale, all over the world. But inevitably, the cultural context that is given to their work leads to good outcomes, and good cultural outcomes lead to good financial outcomes. And that's also not to be sneezed at. That's export dollars. And the international art market is very sophisticated. There's a lot more activity than there is in Australia. We have a very small collectors pool and only a small number of serious collections. And we need to be engaged internationally. So the work that Creative Australia does in supporting artists, but also supporting their presence in exhibitions internationally, is in fact reaping rewards. And it's not something that's ever been measured, but I think it's something we need to look at.
Now, if there's no change of leadership, no reinstatement of Khaled as the Venice representative artist, I understand Khaled and Michael are still intent on presenting the work in Venice. How do you think that will happen?
At the moment, we are looking at a number of options. There's a lot of interest in the work and from various sources around the world. People are paying attention to this internationally. We can't say too much at this stage because things are still in flux. And our dear hope is that he is reinstated. I think that's the best opportunity for this tawdry affair to be put behind us and to go forward with strength, because we really do have a magnificent art scene here in Australia. Some of the most talented artists in the world. We need to support them. We need to get behind them. This is not a time for Creative Australia to trip over its own shoelaces. It's a time to actually get stronger and help us, show the magnificent talent that we have. And just speaking on that, you know, we've got the Emily Nwaro show coming up at the Tate Modern. And this kind of thing wouldn't have happened 5 years ago. So we're at a stage in the evolution of the Australian art scene that really requires us to be focused and to continue to exemplify the best of what we have. As for Khaled and Michael, I have no doubt that their project will go ahead, and it will go ahead hopefully in the pavilion. But if not, there is so much support out there for Khaled to do this. And it's been, to be honest, it's been really heartwarming, and I've never seen the art world so united.
And such a peaceable artist, you know, really it's bizarre to think of him being, of his work being considered to be, you know, glorifying terrorism, which does nothing of the kind, as we discovered last week on the art show. He's such a peacemaker.
Absolutely. Absolutely. For those of us who know him, he's one of the loveliest and most gentle people you're likely to meet.
Josh Malani of Malani Gallery in Brisbane, thanks for being there.
Thanks, Daniel.
This is Arts in 30 on ABC Radio National. I'm Daniel Browning. Now I'm joined by Sarah Hanson-Young, Green Senator and spokeswoman for the arts. who grilled the leadership of Creative Australia in Senate estimates last week. Welcome, Senator. We just heard from Josh Mullany. He's saying that the leadership of Creative Australia needs to go to save the organisation. The Greens have also called for the CEO of Creative Australia to be sacked and the board of Creative Australia to be spilled. Why do you believe that's necessary at this point?
Well, I think what we've seen over the last few weeks is just an absolute mess of how this whole issue has been managed. Yes, I think Mr. Collette needs to go. I think this has been handled appallingly from the top of the organisation. But ultimately, the board made their decision. After drilling the chair and the CEO at Senate Estimates last week, it was quite clear that the board really didn't consider their legal obligations, some basic governance principles. They didn't even consider giving the artists a right of reply. And I think in order to restore integrity of Creative Australia, the peak arts body in the country, I think we need to spill the board and get a new CEO. I would like to say, of course, I know that there is some people on the board who feel and felt very uncomfortable about the decision. You know, maybe those people could be reconsidered, but I think we have to clean this up quickly, and that means spilling the board and getting a new CEO.
Now, you've been quoted as saying that Adrian Collette misled Parliament. What are your specific concerns? What was misleading about his evidence?
Well, one of the things that I was very concerned about is I asked very clearly the timeframes of when each of the decisions were made and when they were communicated. I was shocked to hear that the official contract was not terminated until the day of the Senate Estimates hearing, despite the rash and decision that had been made in haste almost 2 weeks prior. It had taken until the Senate Estimates a day to actually officially terminate the contract. Now, when I asked Mr. Collette in what time that contract was terminated, when that communication was sent, at first he didn't want to answer or struggled to give an answer. He then gave an answer that we've now found out is wrong. And my concern is, and this is very serious, everyone knew that Creative Australia were going to be asked very clear questions at that Senate Estimates hearing. They should have become prepared. And if they can't be forthcoming and honest with the small things, it does make me wonder how much we are being misled or are not getting the fulsome information on the big things.
Do you still agree with the arm's length kind of model, that the decision-making should be made at arm's length from government? And if that's the case, do you think calling for resignations gives the impression of political interference?
I absolutely think that the decisions of what art is supported, the motivations and how we support and fund and lift up public art should be at arm's length from individual politicians. Absolutely, I do. But my concern here is that that's the exact opposite to what has happened in this case, and that is why the integrity of Creative Australia is now in such free fall. And it was quite clear that the rash and in haste decision to sack and to revoke the application and the commission to the artistic team was done off the back of politics. And the fact that it was raised in Senate Estimates and only within a matter of hours, the decision was made to abolish that commission, to reverse a decision that had only been announced 6 days prior. I mean, that is political interference at its very height, and that is the problem. And if you can't expect, and if artists and creatives and the community cannot expect the peak arts body to stand up for artists and artistic integrity and agency, then I think we've got a real problem.
Do you think, I mean, there's a line to be trodden, isn't there, between, you know, government funding and being embarrassed by, you know, the work of an artist? Like, I mean, I think when your income is derived from government sources, you know, governments can kind of, and tend to, overplay their hand. They tend to think they can tell artists what to do. That's a kind of structural problem, I think, with arts funding in this country. But do you think there is a line in what can be said by artists and what should be funded by government bodies?
Well, I think the key here, and this is why I'm so disappointed and frankly so concerned about the precedent that has been set here, is because actually publicly funded art is really important. It's a fundamental part of a vibrant and robust democracy. It sends a message to the broader community and to industry and business and to government that art and creativity is a fundamental part of our society, that it cuts across a whole lot of other portfolio areas, that it's important for our economy, it's important for our education system, it's important for democracy. And so publicly funded art and publicly funded art programs are so vital, and they need to be protected, and they do need to be independent and be given the space to be independent. And you know, there's always going to be arguments about whether a particular piece of artwork or a particular description of a work is in line with current government thinking. But sure, have that debate. But the peak art body of the nation should be there defending artistic freedom of expression. It shouldn't be trying to knock off the edges to make things less topical and more banal. And that is the precedent, that the dangerous precedent that has now been set. And we talk about cancel culture. I mean, what has happened here is literally culture being cancelled. Yeah. It has gone. It has gone way beyond the realms of political debate over a piece of work. Internationally, this decision has really shown Australia to be totally inept with understanding the needs and the powers of artistic freedom and the power of creativity to unlock innovation and critical thought.
The Greens have announced their arts policy. You've called for streamers to invest 20% of Australian subscriber revenue into local content. How does that actually work in practice, and how important is the distinction between revenue and profit?
This is a really, really important policy, and I am frustrated, and I know many who work within Australia's screen industry and some of our best storytellers in the nation are frustrated, because there was promises made by the current Labor government that they would move on this issue, that for far too long, we've seen the big streaming companies, Netflix, Disney, Amazon, pick up a huge number of subscriptions in Australia. So Australians paying their monthly subscriber fees to access content with no requirement for these big companies, which tend to be based in the US, putting back into the local Australian industry. Just like decades ago, it was decided that if television companies were going to have access to the free-to-air licenses, that there needed to be a dividend of making sure that Australian made content, Australian stories, were part of the obligations that they had to invest in and show. And what we're saying here is that these big streaming giants need to do the same. So 20% of what they earn in Australia from the profits they make by charging Australians every month their $15 a month or $19 a month or more, that 20% of that would need to be invested back into Australia. Our storytelling power is immense if it's supported properly. And part of supporting that is making sure the people who are making profits off subscriptions here right now in Australia have to invest something in the local economy and the local industry.
What are the Greens offering for the live performance sector? Because, you know, live venues across Australia have been struggling in recent years. There are many challenges behind that. Insurance costs are a real concern. What are you offering the performance sector?
We've pulled together a $2 billion sustainability fund, which would cover things like helping for those live events access insurance. I've called and written to the minister a number of times about this, and that insurance premiums, particularly for festivals and live events, are becoming really crippling. And as I say this, I think about the extreme weather events that are building up on the east coast of the country right now.
I'm in the midst of it.
Well, you know, this is something that is real. It's happening, and it has a devastating effect on communities across the board, of course. But our arts festivals and industries are really being hit the hardest, just like they were during COVID. Extreme weather events are now hitting them hard, and insurance is very, very hard to fit into the budgets. So insurance is one element. Making sure that people can access a capital grants fund for upgrading facilities or expanding facilities so that we have places to celebrate and experience art and performance. That's a really important one. I've heard from so many, particularly in our regional areas and in our suburbs, local community arts organisations who have all the goodwill in the world and amazing talent, ability to tap into their local communities and want to tell their local communities stories and involve them, but they simply don't have the bricks and mortar to participate in that way and at that level. So a capital grants fund would help to do that. And we've also started to look at some elements around an offset for live performance, similar to what the film industry has with their producer offset. So if there are facilities, venues and promoters that are investing in live performance, that there is some type of tax offset that can help them be sustainable. We'll have some more to say about that policy in particular in the coming weeks.
And one last thing, your living wage, you've revived that policy, living wage for artists. Just give us a very brief, sense of what you're offering there.
Well, this is something that has been trialled in other places around the world, particularly Europe and in some parts of the UK. This is an acknowledgement that so many artists are the original gig workers. And kind of going from gig to gig or from commission to commission.
And many work.
It really is, we all know, it's a tough job being an artist, and very few break through to a level where that is their only income that can sustain them. So many are doing other jobs on the side to pay the bills, despite the amazing contribution that arts can, particularly those community-based artists and professionals, give to the rest of us. So this would be a pilot program of up to 10,000 artists for a living wage to allow them to at least cover some of the living costs while they get on with their art. And I think it's something that Australia should do. We acknowledge the amazing contribution. In fact, thinking about when times are tough, when there's bushfires or floods,
pandemic.
Or a pandemic, who is it that we rely on for raising money for charities, of entertaining us and lifting our spirits? It's artists. And so often they get asked to do that for free. And so often they have to, compromise their contribution because they're having to, you know, work other jobs on the side just to be able to afford the paint or to afford the license fees.
If you do end up with the balance of power, how do you make these proposals real? How do you manifest these great proposals? How do you make them real in practice?
Yeah. That's a really good question. One of the things we've done in the preparation of this policy is to have it all be submitted through the Parliamentary Budget Office. So it's officially and fully costed. So that's the first thing. So in a minority government, in balance of power, there's always going to be opportunities to negotiate and to talk to the government about things they want to see done, and in exchange things that we want to see done and what we want to see prioritised. And we now have all these policies properly costed and looked at, and I can submit them to government and say, look, we really need a proper investment in art in this country, in our creative industries, and here's some ideas that we've looked at and we think would work. What can we get done? You never get everything you want, but it's often, and I've been in minority government before, in terms of when we've had minority government in Canberra, I know how this works, and often it's having the ideas on the table that you can push when the opportunity comes and arises that gets the best outcome. So, I'll be pushing hard for this. And given the background that's going on right now in terms of how tough Australian artists are doing and faring with costs of living pressures, with the insurance elements, with the extreme weather, and now with this crisis of how we even think about publicly supported art through the crisis of Creative Australia, artists really need a strong voice in Canberra, and they'll need a strong voice in a minority parliament. And this is the offering I'm giving, and the Greens are giving. I want to be really clear about this. Art is such a fundamental part of a working and successful democracy. And I want that to be front and centre of everything that we do, of how we engage with government and making sure we can get outcomes. I have the back of artists here in this policy, and I'll be pushing hard for them.
One last question. What's your favourite piece of Australian art from the past year that you've consumed?
Oh, wow. That's a good question. I've seen so many interesting things lately, actually. The Adelaide Fringe Festival is on, and the Fringe. This weekend, I'm off to WOMAD. I love performance. I love live art. And I reckon a whole lot of what's going on here in Adelaide, in my hometown, over these last few weeks, I couldn't beat it. It's just, it makes our city come alive. It reminds us of what makes us feel. I love being challenged, and I just love the buzz that people get from experiencing something different. So I couldn't choose one thing, to be honest. I just love the whole atmosphere.
Senator, thanks for joining me on Arts in 30.
Thank you.
Green Senator and spokeswoman for the arts, Sarah Hanson-Young. And we also have requests in with the Minister for the Arts, Tony Burke, and Shadow Spokeswoman Claire Chandler. And we hope to have them join us as well in coming weeks. And don't forget to check out the music show this weekend. It's coming live to you from WOM Adelaide. You're listening to Radio National. I'm Daniel Browning. And every week here on Arts in 30, I'm joined by a music aficionado from across the ABC's music networks to bring you the one track you should be listening to, our track of the week. And this week, Casey Green from ABC Classic joins me. Casey, welcome. What's our track of the week?
Hey, so the track I have today is called Emanuele, and it's off this new album by Abel Salace. Abel is an incredible South African cellist, composer and vocalist who draws from an incredible variety of influences, including the history of his homeland in South Africa, but also his musical training in the Western classical tradition.
He's amazing. I mean, this song's incredible. It really is just like an earworm. You can't get it out of your head.
I know. It's incredible. And so it comes from this South African hymn of the same name, and it's actually dedicated to people who work with their hands. And this piece follows this traditional Western four-part harmony, but it incorporates African rhythm, and it starts with this really simple bass line, but it grows into something that really makes you want to dance.
Mm-hmm. And it's a bit of a religious kind of, there's a religious infection. It's Emmanuel is one of the Christ's names.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And I feel like Abel's music really, you know, transcends the borders of genre. And, you know, there's a real electricity and energy of his performances. And he's actually on tour with the Australian Chamber Orchestra next month. So people can check him out in most capital cities. I think it'll be a really great one.
Can you throw to this one for us?
Okay. So I hope you enjoy this track, Emanuele by Abel Salace.
Take.
That was Emanuele by Abel Salachwe, off his new album Hymns of Bantu, the track chosen by our music correspondent, Casey Green. And that's all the time we have this week. Arts in 30 is produced by Sky Kirkham. Our executive producer is C. Benedict. Riley Mellis is our sound engineer. I'm Daniel Browning. Join me again next week for more Arts in 30. And remember, you can find all of our episodes to listen whenever you want. Just head to the ABC Listen app. Look for Arts in 30 and remember to press the heart button to follow us.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.